John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast. It's The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Leaving no one behind. You've heard that before. It's the long-standing ethos on the battlefield for U.S. soldiers and Marines. And after 5 years, this just-released video of the freeing of Bo Bergdahl shows Taliban fighters handing a gaunt but healthy-looking man over to soldiers who rush him onto a U.S. Army chopper for the flight to Bagram Air Base and the long trip home to his family in Idaho. But did that leave no one behind ethos put soldiers needlessly at risk in the case of Bergdahl, as we learn more about the circumstances of his capture by the Taliban? Should the circumstances of someone's capture even be relevant if they become an enemy hostage? And did the Army deliberately cover things up in the Bergdahl case? We will explore all of that on this Red Letter Day, or Red Letter Week, a quarter century after the Chinese crackdown on students and workers in Tiananmen Square in Beijing, 25 years since the death of Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran, approaching the 70th year anniversary of the D-Day invasion that marked the beginning of the end of World War II, and a quarter century since Poland became the first real crack in the Soviet fortress around Eastern Europe. President Obama is in Poland for that. But first, to the Bergdahl questions. Was this the right deal?
The president needs to look the American people in the eye and explain to the American people why he was justified in releasing the five individuals and why their background didn't demand and mandate that they be detained at Guantanamo for an indefinite period of time.
We'll talk about criticism of this prisoner exchange from Congress, Senator Saxby Chambliss of Georgia there, and other Republicans with Todd Zwillick in just a moment. But first, other soldiers now say they are free to speak about something they were prohibited to talk about while Bergdahl was in captivity. Bergdahl was no hero, caught in the heat of battle, they say, but someone who wandered off deliberately, possibly trying to hike his way out of Afghanistan, technically a deserter. The Secretary of the Army, John McHugh, says all of those claims will be investigated. Nathan Bradley Bethay was serving as an infantry officer in the U.S. Army from 2007 to 2014. He's out of the Army now, but he participated in the initial attempts to retrieve Sergeant Bergdahl in the summer of 2009.
I don't think anybody would say an American soldier should not be rescued if the opportunity presents itself. I firmly have the belief that it is a good thing that Bergdahl was brought back, and I want him to be able to be back in the United States. I think that in his case, the frustrating part of it has been that we haven't had the ability to talk about what actually happened. And as a result of that, the unit wound up looking very shoddy because of the fact that the story getting circulated in 2009 was that he had lagged behind on a patrol and then he had been captured because we weren't paying attention effectively.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about what a lot of people who are listening to this might be saying to themselves. People who have, read accounts of what happened in Afghanistan, and that sometimes soldiers are deployed to forward operating bases that are in valleys where they're basically target practice for Taliban soldiers and for Al-Qaeda soldiers, and that it's a very, very terrifying, difficult situation to be out on the edge of wilderness in Afghanistan, so cut off from even air support. Desertion might be a rational response to a situation like that. How do you respond?
You know, Bergdahl could have sat on the ground and said, I refuse to fight, and they would have eventually transported him back to the United States, and that wouldn't have put thousands of people's lives at risk. If a guy, either because of psychological dysfunction or because of ethical difficulty with what the job requires, decides he can't do it anymore, that's one thing. I mean, I've seen soldiers who after having enlisted and then facing a deployment, say that they are conscientious objectors. The response to the stimulus, to the stress, to the fear is one thing, but the problem is that because we don't leave anybody behind, doing this wantonly creates a situation in which we have to go and expend energy to recover him. And we don't disagree with the idea that he must be recovered, but it's frustrating to not acknowledge why does he need to be recovered? What is it that he did that got him into that situation in the first place? And I mean, you know, I left the army out of a variety of reasons, but one of them was I was very frustrated with what I saw how the war was going. And to be honest with you, that's a decision he could have made, but he walked off into the night and thereby required people to go and chase him down in a place as dangerous as what you just described. And thousands of guys had to go search for him unsuccessfully and in the process got hurt. And honestly, I believe there were cases in which guys died because of what was going on, you know, what they were subjected to in that search.
Do you know some of the people who were injured or killed in that search?
I do. I know of I know the names of two guys that were killed in an attack on a large outpost, or correction, a small outpost on the border with Pakistan. It was the sister battalion in our brigade. That was their area. There was a huge kind of human wave attack that took place on July 4th, 2009. And everybody that I know in that unit claimed that they were unable to receive air support for quite a bit of time, longer than normal, because of the fact that all of the air support in theater had been reallocated towards trying to rescue Bergdahl. I also remember helping guys off an aircraft that had been wounded in the search for Bergdahl in early July 2009. In my own battalion, there were guys that died around the time of the election, and some of the guys that died definitely were actioning targets that were in some way related to Bergdahl. They were chasing after Taliban sub-governors that were supposedly affiliated with the guys who were holding Bergdahl and could potentially give information, or they were, you know, searching the area. They were checking in the villages around where he had disappeared. But it was a very different climate around the election. We were still doing missions to chase down Bergdahl. It wasn't the massive overwhelming focus, because by that point they knew he was in Pakistan. So to answer your question in the shortest way, absolutely yes.
Nate, do you believe the Army covered this up, that this is basically a top-down cover-up of something that really conceals facts that put you and some of your men in jeopardy?
I think that it was always understood that Bergdahl was going to have to be traded at some point once he was guaranteed, you know, he was known that he was a prisoner. And the Army understood that telling the truth about what happened could potentially damage his value as a prisoner. And I also think there's a lot of people that were just embarrassed by what happened, people whose military careers might be, you know, poorly reflected given that this happened. And as a result, before we left, everybody in the brigade was told to sign a non-disclosure agreement saying we were banned from talking about Bergdahl basically ever. It said everything related to the efforts to recover him were classified secret, and we weren't allowed to talk about them to anyone, certainly not in any kind of written or social media form. And if anyone in our families had any question, they could direct that question to the Operation Enduring Freedom Public Affairs Office, which is effectively to say your family can call Afghanistan if they want to. They can call someone at Bagram to get the story. It was intended to stop people from spreading it, because I think it was embarrassing.
Didn't stop you.
It didn't stop me, because I knew that he's back. There's a lot of politics wrapped up in this right now. And I know a lot of people that are, even some of the soldiers are far more extreme in their views towards Bergdahl, what they think should happen to him. But I want people to know what happened. At the same time, I am absolutely thrilled that he's back, because it bothered me. It was a thorn in my side, in my conscience, in a sense, that one last guy from our unit was still there, was still in their custody. I'm happy that he's back. There shouldn't be American soldiers left to be POWs just because it's politically inconvenient. We should bring them all home, is my take. But he got himself in that mess by his own volition.
Nathan Bradley Bethay served as an infantry officer in the U.S. Army from 2007 to 2014. He's now retired from the Army. The status of Bo Bergdahl and the circumstances of his capture and the secret deal that released him are rapidly becoming the latest sparring opportunity for lawmakers on Capitol Hill. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, joins me now. Welcome, Todd.
Hi, John.
So let's start it off with the Senator John McCain, who really says something that I have some questions about, and I'd love to talk to you about it here.
I think we should continue to seek, we should have certainly made efforts to bring Bergdahl home. But this price is higher than any in history. And yes, I know about exchanges of prisoners and all that. I have never known of an exchange of prisoners that involved this kind of individuals, these five, who are wanted for war crimes.
At the risk of getting my email, you know, inbox filled with hate mail, I mean, doesn't John McCain have a little compassion here? I mean, he was a POW. He was, you know, forced to make a statement against U.S. Government under torture, and he came back to the United States. And, you know, why can't he just accept this situation here? What are his principal strategic questions?
This is exactly why everybody goes to John McCain with these questions, because he has been in sort of both positions here in a debate like this. John McCain, along with several other Republicans, John, have principled objections to this deal because of what they say is the high value for the Taliban of the detainees who were released in exchange for Bo Bergdahl. Now, there are other questions about Congress being informed and who knew what and when people were told, and maybe we can get to a little bit of that as well. But McCain's primary objection here is that the deal doesn't keep these five off the battlefield. They go to Qatar, where they will be monitored by the Qataris for a year. And then, according to McCain and others, it's back to Afghanistan. And he says, you can bet, and I'll bet you right now, that they're back in the fight against the United States.
But they've been at Gitmo since 2002. I mean, they've been out of the game for a while here.
That's true. I think part of the conflict that you hear on Capitol Hill right now, and there's a lot of criticism from both sides of the aisle, by the way, about this decision on this prisoner swap. A lot of the conflict that you hear is similar to the conflict that Nathan Bethea just related to you, that soldier who was in Bergdahl's unit. Happy that he's home. He should be home because you don't leave somebody behind, so you go and get him. Conflicted about the nature of the deal, conflicted about the nature of his service. And some Republicans have gone as far as to say this deal should not have made. We're happy for his family, but he should still be in captivity because this deal should not have been made.
You know, one of the things that's come out of this discussion here is McCain said something. I don't know if he said it to you directly yesterday, that McCain has no confidence in the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff right now. He literally said he has no credibility with me, and I've dealt with many, many, many of them. Yeah. What's he talking about there?
He did say that to me directly, John, and that was when I asked him, when McCain said it's ridiculous to release these five prisoners, I said, well, Chuck Hagel, the defense secretary, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff have certified in writing that these five prisoners released in exchange for Bo Bergdahl do not pose a significant security threat, and that in that sense, it's a safe deal to make. And McCain turned to me and said, that's a crazy assessment. Martin Dempsey has no credibility with me. He has a problem with Dempsey over his assessment of intervention in Syria, and thinks that Dempsey sort of politicized it and carried water for the White House. I think it goes back to that.
Oh, that's a major piece of news you got there, Scott, Todd. So can Congress do anything about this?
Well, there's going to be hearings for sure, and there may even be some closed hearings for senators on the nature of the notification here. Look, Saxby Chambliss, who we heard from at the top, who's the senior Republican on the Intel Committee, says he's going to demand that the White House declassify the files on these five Taliban fighters, that they call them Mullah Omar's cabinet, so that the American public can see whether they're dangerous or not. I don't know if the White House will comply with that. Next move, there's going to be hearings on the Hill, John, I'm sure.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks as always.
You bet.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Egypt's ex-army chief Abdel Fattah el-Sisi just won nearly 100% of the votes in the country's presidential election. Certainly a great victory for him personally, but hardly an endorsement of Egyptian democracy after the Arab Spring, especially after the overthrow of the elected Islamist government headed by Mohamed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Brotherhood, now officially declared a terrorist organization by the Egyptian government, not even technically the opposition anymore. Egyptians are once again disillusioned, and satirist Bassem Youssef, who has tangled with the law over his brand of humor, speaks here.
So here it is. They think that they can get away by their own agenda, and they will tell you, oh, yeah, it's a democracy. You can say what you want, but do it. Be polite.
Yes.
Be nice. Be presentable. It's like, what is that?
free on The Daily Show. But the problem for democracy in the Middle East and even in the United States, Shadi Hamin says, is a big problem. Ideological groups often benefit from elections at the expense of liberal pluralism. Hamid is the author of Temptations of Power, Islamists and Illiberal Democracy in a New Middle East.
I think we have to readjust our expectations. You can't have a revolution and then have liberal democracy overnight. Democracy takes a long time to play out, and we see that in transitions across the world, and not just in the Middle East. So there is going to be inevitably an initial phase where you see elected leaders maybe suppressing dissent or trying to pass illiberal legislation in the social arena and trying to push their ideas on the population through the democratic process. But you hope that over time, democracy self-corrects. And instead of having military coups, which end the democratic process as we know it, I think it would have been much more preferable to let these processes play out. And I think we're seeing that right now in Egypt, where the military steps in, you have less stability, you have unprecedented repression. I think it would be very difficult for anyone to argue that the situation now is better than it was under the Muslim Brotherhood, as disappointing as the Brotherhood was in their 1 year in power. And I think also as Americans, it's a little bit challenging for us because we're small L liberals and small D Democrats. But what happens when those two values come into conflict and you have religious parties coming to power through democracy? And that's why I think the U.S. has had a lot of trouble with this, that we support democracy in theory, but we're not always comfortable with democratic outcomes in practice.
Your book speaks mostly of Islamists and in the Arab world in the Middle East, but I'm wondering if this is a much broader issue. I mean, we have in the European Union, all of a sudden, the election of people who want to do away with the European Union entirely, and they're going to have to deal with that. And one could certainly make an argument, don't you think, that in Israel, democratic institutions have favored and allowed development and growth of ultranationalist and religious parties, even in Israel.
Exactly. This notion of illiberal democracy isn't unique to the Middle East, even if it might be more pronounced there. And Israel is a very good example of where we see this outside of the Arab world, where you do have far-right religious parties that play a very important role in government and parliament. Or we can even look further afield to India. And just the other week, we see not just an illiberal prime minister elected, but a prime minister who was implicated in the past in being complicit in pogroms against the Muslim minority in India. Whether it's Hindu nationalism, the far right in Israel, or even neo-fascist groups in Europe, we see a general trend here. And I think that's the challenge in any democracy, is where do you find the right balance between respecting the will of the people and also protecting the rights of disadvantaged minorities.
Does it stretch the American notion of tolerance for, a different view of human rights, that it appears that what Egypt has done is basically deliver a never mind to the entire Arab Spring Revolution, which happened in 2010 and has essentially gone back to a kind of Mubarak system where the Muslim Brothers are now underground? Do Egyptians prefer this above-ground military rule with the Muslim Brothers tolerated but definitely in the background?
So this is the real challenge here, especially in the early phase of transitions. People usually say that they support democracy, but then the real test of it is when you have parties that come to power that threaten their personal interests or their way of life. And in the Middle East, you have this fundamental ideological divide between Islamists and secularists or liberals, and they have very distinctive worldviews and visions for their society. So what you end up having is really the zero-sum battle over the future of these states. And the more existential politics is, the less willing you are to accept your opponents. Instead, you want to destroy them. And that's what I think we've seen in Egypt. Now, there always have to be limits on what popular majorities can do. So no one is saying here that Islamists have the right to impose female genital mutilation or to disenfranchise Christian voters. But the question is, where do you draw the line? Where do you say that majorities can't do this, or what can they do? And the only way you can really figure that out is through a process of democratic bargaining and give and take through everyday politics. And we've had that in our own history as Americans, where you have a lot of these debates, but that has to be worked out.
What's the progressive model then in the Middle East right now? Is it the sort of disorganized, chaotic thuggery in Libya? Is it the sectarian nightmare that's taking place in Iraq right now? Or is it the benign autocracy in a place like Qatar?
I think what we're seeing is a new anti-democratic trend where a growing number of Egyptians and Libyans and Syrians are looking towards strongmen. They want this strong dictator who's a kind of protector and savior who can come in and bring order and stability. And that's a natural result when you have a democratic process that doesn't actually improve people's standard of living. And that was a big part of the Arab Spring, if you recall. It wasn't just about having the right to vote. It was also about dignity and being able to feed your family and improve their standard of living. But democracy doesn't bring that right away. It actually can be unstable in the short run. So I think a lot of Egyptians said to themselves, well, this isn't exactly what we had in mind when we were supporting the democratic process. So you have a general disillusionment, and I think more and more people are falling under this illusion that a strong man like General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi in Egypt, or even in Libya, where we're seeing the rise of militias and former generals who are trying to assert themselves through the use of force.
Shadi Hamid is a fellow at the Brookings Institution Saban Center and author of Temptations of Power, Islamist and Illiberal Democracy in a New Middle East. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's play a little Around the USA in 80 dialects, right? Virginia, Brooklyn, Chicago, Minnesota, California, but Boston, that's hard.
Blood, I'm his family.
I'm the one fighting, okay? Not you, and not you. I know what I need.
And you need Dickie?
I want Dickie back. And I want you, Charlene, and I want O'Keefe. I want my family. What's wrong with that?
Actor Mark Wahlberg comes by it naturally, but some don't. Like Johnny Depp trying to get in character for his upcoming film Black Mass about crime boss Whitey Bulger. Can he do it? Well, if he fails, it won't be the first time. Longtime casting director and dialect coach Angela Perry specializes in Boston speak and says, to begin, you actually have to delete some letters of the alphabet. Angela, welcome.
Thank you.
So with Southern accent being maybe one of the easiest for actors to do in the U.S., British maybe being second, how hard is Boston?
I'd say about 35. Number 35, yeah. It's the hardest accent to get. Like Christian Bale, although he's the master at it, they all have a hard time. No one can drop the R's. They just want to keep using those R's, and we don't use the R.
So, but that's the old, you know, I left the car in Harvard Yard.
Yeah, park your car.
Park your car.
Park your car.
In Harvard Yard.
In Harvard Yard. The other one is my mother met my father on the Charles River.
So what do you make of, well, I mean, Matt Damon doesn't count because he's Bostonian, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so forget him. Wahlberg, it seems like he's got some sort of New England connection. I mean, he's great.
He's awesome. He's a Dorchester guy. Matt, Ben, Mark,
yeah,
those guys, they
Dorchester
get
guy, Dorchester guy.
Yeah.
Sorry, so he doesn't count. Mm-hmm. What about Nicholson in The Departed? He was amazing, I thought.
Why don't you stay in the bar? That night I got your numbers.
Oh, are you kidding? I hated his accent.
Really?
It came and went. It didn't work for me. No.
Really?
Yeah, we're really critical to the Bostonians when we do hear it. When people are trying to do the Boston accent, we get it, hear it right away if they're going to get it or not.
I'll tell you one that I love, though. Mystic River, there were a lot of great accents in there.
My own little daughter, and I can't even cry for it.
Jimmy, you're crying now.
Yeah.
Do you want me to leave you alone?
I'll just sit here for a minute if that's cool.
How did Tim Robbins do?
Sean Penn,
Sean Penn was
pretty
good.
I don't know. I'm tough.
Really?
I'm tough. No, Sean Penn
kidding.
Wasn't that great.
Really?
Yeah, I'm really tough with it.
So what is the challenge when you've got an actor that's,
you know, having a little trouble here? I mean, is it just get it as good as you can, or does the actor get full of anxiety, or what happens?
Yes, all of those things. But I think the key is bringing your dialect coaches in that are local people, that are local dialect coaches, because these dialect coaches from California and whatnot, they don't even get the accent. What also helps is when you have a local actor that has a Boston accent, read the script, and then we tape it and give that to the actor, to one of the leads also, so he can hear an authentic local person be coached by a dialect coach with experience, but that's also a local person, because this is a darn hard accent to learn unless you've lived here. And I'm sorry. And I've been in this business 30 years. So that's my take on it.
All right. Clearly, I need to do some work with you, Angela.
Yes. I'll coach you. It's easy.
Angela Parry is a Boston casting director for over 30 years. Angela, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
China and the U.S. compete in every economic sphere. They also compete as environmental menaces. In 2010, China passed the U.S. as the largest energy consumer in the world. It also has become the largest emitter of carbon and other pollutants. Now the two nations are competing in plans to clean it all up. This week, President Obama announced a proposal to cut carbon emissions from existing power plants by up to 30%. And this week, China says it will limit pollutants from coal plants for the very first time, with an absolute cap in place by 2016. Joining us is Jennifer Turner, director of the China Environment Forum at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington. Jennifer, welcome.
Ni hao, John.
Thank you. Ni hao. What's the message from Beijing, do you think?
Well, I mean, this announcement that came out was from an advisor of the government, and so it's not set in stone, but it's a really a strong indication that China is continuing to move in the direction of controlling emissions from coal. I mean, you're talking about CO2 emissions, but in China, the bigger concern for the Chinese public is the fact that coal is the major source of a lot of the smog that's been plaguing the cities, I mean, for the past decade, but increasingly worse over the past two. So over the last year, China issued actually a pollution action plan, kind of like superhero cape kind of sounding stuff, you know, that they were going to cap coal use below 65%. Of total energy consumption. It's about 70 today, have coal-free zones. And it's been very kind of exciting to see that some of the cities in China, because, you know, the general public has been horrified that some cities are even going beyond what the government is requiring them right now in terms of trying to cap their consumption. And so it's a really positive trend. But in great part, a lot of this is it's motivated for, you know, local health and economy.
So it's really a message to the domestic economy and the outrage of people who are enduring this atmospheric problem. So we're talking about sulfur dioxide and particulates and the kinds of heavy metals that really dirty coal burning can produce.
Yeah, well, the PM 2.5, I think early in January this year, at one point, it was around 900 on the air quality index. And, you know, in the United States, we panic if it would get anywhere near 100 in any of our cities. I mean, it's the numbers of 1.2 million people dying early from respiratory disease, lots more asthma incidences. And people, I mean, people now can get live air quality updates. That's another significant change, is that the government has, you know, admitted they set standards for particulate matter 2.5 and mandated that cities had to get this information out. And so, I mean, at minimum, people can know, oh, the air's really bad, got to wear my Darth Vader mask outside today to breathe or don't go out. So there's a lot more transparency and live discussion in China about how to address this.
You know, in many ways, the birth of the Republican Party in the United States was a response to the pollution in cities like Pittsburgh and the economic message of republicanism in the 1800s was cleaning up an extremely filthy Pittsburgh, and it, you know, has had a political legacy that continues even to this day in Pittsburgh. In China, do you think the Chinese industries can actually take a leadership role in developing technologies that can clean up Beijing and Shanghai and, you know, do in the coal cleanup realm what they've already done in developing solar panels and recycling technology?
the Chinese government has led this clean energy revolution, and the industry has responded. I mean, they've got number one installed wind power. They're ramping up solar PV. But at the same time, because their electricity consumption until recently has been accelerating so fast that coal still has dominated. But we are seeing signs that you do have some industry leaders. In this case, Jack Ma, the head of Alibaba, he's focusing on water quality, but that he's actually selling little water sampling kits for the public to sample water and upload it online. And I think he's going to start moving into air as well. So individual leaders, but keep in mind, most industry in China is owned by the government. So that's been the big regulatory slippage in China that, you know, we have these targets, but we own the industry and our local government makes money from it. So, but that's starting to change because local officials are going to be evaluated whether they can actually meet the air pollution reduction target.
Jennifer Turner, director of the China Environment Forum at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Thanks so much.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Reputation.com, encouraging everyone to check their online search results because search results define you or your business. Learn more at Reputation.com.
June 4th is a special day in China, but it is not officially celebrated. Today, thousands of security forces are on hand to prevent any rallies or protests in Beijing or Tiananmen Square that might recall an event a quarter century ago when young Chinese students and impassioned workers went into the streets to usher in what they thought would be a democratic China. Dissident Wang Zhengtao remembers.
We had hope. We had a dream. We had some kind of idea to build up a new China in which there's no corruption and the people could share the outcome of development.
The noise of gunfire rose from all over the center of Peking. It was unremitting. On the streets leading down to the main road to Tiananmen Square, furious people stared in disbelief at the glow in the sky, listening to the sound of shots. Heading down the road was a hazardous business, but hundreds of people cheered as buses were set alight and army trucks caught fire too. They yelled and shouted. And then, as troop lorries were seen moving down the road, there was gunfire from those lorries.
From the BBC archives, reporter Kate Eady describing the moments when Chinese authorities moved in to crush a crowd of thousands of workers and students. 25 years later, the young people of China have little direct memory of the Tiananmen Square uprising and its brutal suppression. But Wang Zhengtao says the spirit, he believes, is still alive.
That the young generation Chinese may have a different, idea from me, but I believe when they grow up, when they suffer more, in reality, finally, they will follow my idea and conclusion.
A quarter century ago, virtually the entire Western media had gathered to watch the delirious pro-democracy movement in Tiananmen Square. And they also witnessed the end of it all. T.D. Allman was on the scene for Vanity Fair, and he's here with us today. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. It's an honor, John.
So you arrive in the middle of the euphoria, the
yes.
sense that something was possible, this fusion of the naivete and idealism of the students with the passionate activism of the workers who suddenly had the courage to go into the streets. Well,
and remember, these were the brightest students in China, and these were the only ones in history who had gotten into the major universities in Beijing entirely on merit. Before, you could get in on merit or if your family was a high party official. But these kids, they were straight out of the provinces. They had scored 200% on every exam, and they were brilliant, and they were young. It's a strange thing to say, but you have to give backhanded credit to the Communist Party of China. They realized that they faced what is now called an existential threat.
What do you recall?
Oh, I just recall. It was one of those situations. It's going to take us generations to figure out. It was truly a privilege to be there. And as I said, I brought you a show and tell this morning. It's the bullet that got me.
Well, describe that moment. What was it like walking through the square? What did it smell like? What did it feel like?
Oh, it was like an ocean.
Where did that come from?
It was like living next to an ocean. I was in the Beijing Hotel. I had a balcony that looked diagonally on the square. And for those days, I think it was 4 or 5 days, where there was no time. It was a particularity. I forget the exact word in physics. And I could tell what was going on. You'd hear it would be a roar, and sometimes it would be peaceful. And when it really got noisy, I went down. And so I would go down and talk to him. And I remember the night before, the sunset, the statue, the flags. As I said, the comparison is to living next to the ocean or being in the ocean as the sound ebbs and flows. And there was a tanker, not a tank, some sort of tractor or something down at the end. And there was this old man sitting there. And I went up and talked to him. He spoke very good English. And he said, "Are you a journalist?" I said, "Of course." And he looked out at the crowd and he said, "Youth is impetuous." I spent the night up on the roof looking out on the square. And the lights were on. And suddenly they shut off the lights. I can't remember. I think it was 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock. I noted the time. And there was the silence. And then I gripped the railing. And then there was this horrible sound in the darkness of things being crushed. And you couldn't see anything. And dawn was many hours away. And I remember I stood there. I didn't move. It was like it was 10 minutes slowly. And then slowly, 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 the dawn. You know, in Beijing, there's so much smog. It came up. And where all this life and people and flags and life had been was this quadrangle of tanks facing out in every direction. Now, the killing began on this side of the square where I was when the tanks went out. And that was when the guy came out and stopped the tanks. And as I said it, the tanks danced. They went around. They were shooting indiscriminately. It was one of the times in my life, I regret to say, I saw people being killed in front of my very eyes. And then I went back up to the balcony of my thing to observe this. And you ask, what's it like to be hit by a bullet? And I felt this sting. And I thought, I better go put some hydrogen peroxide. You know, like your mother says, go. I later learned that bullets really don't infect you because they're so hot. So I went around, and fortunately it was some people come back from China with knickknacks. I came back with a nick about an inch from a major vein, and I'm very grateful to be alive. And China has many, many fascinating permutations ahead. And it wasn't a happy ending, and it wasn't an unhappy ending, because nothing ever ends in China.
T.D. Allman, thanks so much.
It's an honor.
We started this hour with a discussion of the problems with democracy in Egypt and the Middle East. We conclude this hour noting the success of electoral democracy in the nation of Poland, a totalitarian military dictatorship back in 1989.
25 years ago today, we witnessed a scene that had once seemed impossible. An election where for the first time the people of this nation had a choice. It was the beginning of the end of communism, not just in this country, but across Europe.
President Obama in Warsaw. He's on his way to note another anniversary in the narrative of democracy's triumph in the 20th century. The D-Day invasion 70 years ago was the muscle that pushed the Allies to victory in World War II. That triumph of democracy was the result of an industrial effort that overwhelmed Nazi Germany and represented the largest and fastest industrial mobilization in world history. Journalist A.J. Baim tells that story in his book, The Arsenal of Democracy, FDR, Detroit, and an Epic Quest to Arm an America at War. A.J., welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what had to be created to make America a decisive force in World War II in industrial terms?
Well, I think everything had to be created. One of the fascinating things I think that generations of younger people don't realize now is the fact that we were great underdogs during the war. Hitler and Nazi Germany, they were preparing for this war for years, and we were not, because we were stuck in the Great Depression. So when the war really began and FDR saw us moving in that direction, inevitably, we had to create everything from the ground up. In my research, I found fascinating documents, not just about the American government trying to figure out how to build airplanes and tanks, but desk chairs and uniforms and canteens. We had to build everything.
And the only real industrial infrastructure that had the capacity to even begin this process
existed in Detroit at that time. I mean, there were things that were created around the country, but Detroit was sort of the first up.
Absolutely. You know, the American automobile industry in 1940 had an economy all its own that was larger than almost every nation on Earth. So when FDR really realized that he needed to create this, what he called the arsenal of democracy, he turned to Detroit and its automobile companies for help.
And the funny thing is that it's not completely clear that Henry Ford, you know, was interested in the same outcome of the war as FDR was, at least in the early going.
Well, I handled that material very, very carefully because Henry Ford and also Charles Lindbergh, who worked with Henry Ford and is also a character in this book, they were probably the two most controversial people, you know, public figures outside of government at the time. They were accused anti-Semites. They were accused Nazi sympathizers. But really, when you read the book, you realize that these people were very misunderstood. But once the war started, their hearts were in the right place and they really wanted to become a part of the Allied effort to win.
At any point, was Ford a supplier of the German industrial arsenal? And when did that stop?
Well, again, incredibly controversial material. So a lot of times when writers write about this, I think that they err on the side of forgetting to contextualize this material. So, yes, the fact is that General Motors and Ford both played a role in helping to build the Nazi arsenal. But let's be very clear about how this happened. In the early 1930s, the first years under Hitler, the German economy began to expand rapidly. American companies who had investments in Nazi Germany saw this as a great opportunity. At the dawn of globalism and during the Depression, Germany was a place you were assured of earning profits. Only these American companies were forbidden from taking profits out of Nazi Germany, and therein lies the rub. They didn't have crystal balls, and they didn't have the modern communications that we had today. They did not see war and genocide coming, and they were forced into making some extremely difficult decisions.
There were very risky, innovative, high-pressure industrial problems that were solved, particularly in the aviation industry with the B-17 and the B-29. I mean, these were planes that were both prototypes and production runs going on at the same time. Did they create the company of Boeing and McDonnell Douglas and Curtis?
Absolutely. The main through line of this book that I chose is the story of Henry Ford and his only child, Edsel, who was dying of this terrible disease at the time. Their effort to help build American air power by creating the largest factory under one roof anywhere in the world, the largest airplane factory in the world, to create the B-24 bomber at a rate of one per hour. Now, this was deemed an impossibility at the time. So it sort of became a contest of who could build these airplanes the fastest.
And did people in the factories understand they were part of a war effort? I mean, certainly the Depression had demoralized the American workforce for so long, and people were thrilled to have a job. But were they also thrilled to have a job that was, you know, winning the war for the free world?
I think that's absolutely true. But on the other hand, life was very difficult for a lot of people. Of course, you also had rationing, which means you couldn't get a cup of coffee, you couldn't get a can of beer. People were literally eating muskrat meat from butchers, you know?
And, you know, in this particular industrial enterprise, which was so extraordinarily successful, I mean, up to that time, Ford and Edsel Ford and Henry Ford, you know, when they developed a product, they'd roll it out and have a sort of sales and marketing campaign. In this case, the product rollout was quite literally the D-Day invasion of northern France. How much of the scale of D-Day represented the scale of this industrial enterprise?
Well, let me say two things about that. For starters, just the story of the Fords, what's fascinating to me about it is it really illuminates, it's one story, but it illuminates what was happening everywhere in the country. They tried to do something that had never been done and people thought couldn't be done. They tried to take what was at the time the biggest, fastest, most destructive heavy bomber in our arsenal and turn it into the most mass-produced military aircraft of all time, which it still is today, the B-24 bomber. It's fascinating. And in terms of when you get to D-Day, the way I situate in the book, I have this amazing quote from Eisenhower when he steps onto the beach and he says, "There was no sight in the war that so impressed me with the industrial might of America as the wreckage on the landing beaches. To any other nation, the disaster would have been almost decisive. But so great was America's productive capacity that the great storm occasioned little more than a ripple in the development of our buildup." So really, the D-Day invasion was the climactic moment of the war, but also the climax of the arsenal of democracy. We delivered the trucks, the tanks, the airplanes, the canteens, the tents that won the war.
And the Nazis, who were so proud of their industrial enterprise, were simply overwhelmed as that invasion pushed this industrial might in and overland and on its way to Berlin. How clear was it to the Germans that it was this industrial, unstoppable force that was going to be decisive?
In the book, I quote from the diary of Albert Speer, who was Hitler's head production man. And he, you know, he says fascinating things in his diary about the American four-engine bomber. And he would say, you know, he saw the end of the war coming when he would wake up in the morning and look out into the southern sky and see the American Air Forces coming in with their bomber runs. He could see doom in his near future.
A.J. Baim, journalist and author of The Arsenal of Democracy, FDR, Detroit, and an Epic Quest to Arm an America at War, all about World War II. A.J. Baim, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Hard to imagine an economic stimulus program on that scale, thinking about D-Day 70 years ago. But while you're thinking about that, earlier this hour, we learned how to master the best Boston accent, right? Alexia gave us hers.
Hi, this is Alexia from Massachusetts. And in terms of accents, my grandpa has the most amazing Boston accent. My mom's got the most amazing Boston accent. And from them to you, I wanted to say, have a wicked happy birthday and potty hod.
Potty hod. Thank you, Alexia. That was very sweet. Give us your best Boston accent at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Where am I going to potty hod? Tweet at The Takeaway. You know, got to keep doing that. And if you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the show, check us out at thetakeaway.org. If you want to send me a present, the address... Oh, I can't. I'm not allowed to do that. Right. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Reputation.com, encouraging everyone to check their online search results because search results define you or your business. Learn more at Reputation.com. TiVo, recording up to 6 shows at once and 3,000 hours, plus Netflix, Hulu Plus, and YouTube. All on the TiVo Romeo DVR. TiVo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.